Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about season 3, episode 10. It's the season finale called Misa. What do you think, Aaron?
Misa like Misa Jar Jar Banks. Misa.
Who's the Jar Jar in Dany's crew?
I think it's double D's because they're racially tone deaf like George Martin.
I thought this is
can't possibly be as shocking and dumbfounded as the last episode, but it does a really good job, like most Game of Thrones season finales do, of resetting the table, giving you things to look forward to, giving you real hopes, false hopes, all kinds of things. And there's a lot of really good character work with Tyrion and Cersei, and perhaps the only good Shay scene in existence.
Because Varys is in it.
And because, yeah, I was going to say, because she has Varys carrying her. But that's the best. I think this is peak Shay we've hit here. So that's my thought. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I look at the scenes like you were saying with Cersei, the scenes with Tywin. I mean, Charles Dance, every single time he's on screen, knocks it out of the park. The scenes with Davos and Gendry, I thought were good. Like Davos telling him about, you know, his son and how he grew up in Flea Bottom.
Right.
And you really get like a sense of who Davos is a little bit more. I thought all of that character work is really good. And then, you know, there's, like you said, there's not much exciting, but we're setting the plate for next season.
Yeah. And there's just some really cool visuals.
It's
kind of bookended. You see like Roose on top of the battlements of the twins looking down at the chaos and destruction. And then we end with this like aerial crane shot of Dany being adored by the masses that she's freed over there in Slaver's Bay. Some really, really cool visuals. There's a really nice scene of like the Night Fort from a distance, huddled beneath the shadow of the wall. There's a lot of really cool visuals in the episode too, which, you know, they had to have spent a lot of budget last, you know, in the chaos of the last episode. So it was nice to see some grace notes for this episode.
Yeah, I do think more of the budget was on display in this episode. You know, if you look at the Red Wedding and you say, okay, where did the budget go? It probably went mostly into this episode, because that first battle scene that we see where you're talking about Roose up on the walls, like, that looks like $1 million. I mean, the choreography, just the set dressing, all the fire everywhere. I mean, it looks amazing. And then another very, very striking visual that I just can't get out of my head after watching this episode is Rob with the wolf's head.
Yeah.
That is fucked up. And they did such a great job just showing how fucked up that is.
Yeah, and letting Arya see it, and the Hound trying to shield her from it, like it's good. And also, we see kind of Arya unleashed as a young wolf into her own right in this episode, like a little glimpse of what, you know, this is the life that she wants for herself at this point. And the great thing about Maisie Williams is you can still feel like, hey, that's a pretty cool power fantasy, but also it's a fucking tragedy. That this little girl is reduced to this. So lots of stuff, lots of good stuff all around. Hardly anything that I could dismiss as like bad or shitty. In fact, I don't think there's anything. This is a really solid finale episode.
All right, let's get into the recap.
Hey, everybody, before we get to the episode, I got one last time to talk to you about things that are going on at Bald Move, because I hope you stay with us. We've got Better Call Saul season 4 is in full swing. We do that every Monday. We have an instant take after the first airing, and every Wednesday we have the full coverage. If you're a club member, you can join in that instant take, the instant talk part, by logging in with your username on baldmove.com and clicking through to the YouTube link so you can YouTube chat with us. That's pretty cool. My wife and I are starting, Cecily, starting our American Horror Story podcast back up with the return of season 8. Check that out. Jim and I are also, now the Sharp Objects are over, covering David Simon's The Deuce on HBO. We're doing that on the Bald Move TV feed. Tonight we're seeing Mandy, a crazy horror film in limited release starring the incomparable Nicolas Cage. we're pretty excited about. Last week we saw The Nun. We're kind of on a horror kick. I don't know if people have noticed this. Also for club members, The Empire Business, which is a behind-the-scenes looks at Bald Move and a podcasting startup, is a series that we're doing. We got 6 to 8 topics planned. We're going to be dropping once a week. Our first one, doing a deep dive on our club statistics and our plans for the future, just dropped this week. Check that out. And finally, since this is the last time I get to talk to the Game of Thrones audience for a couple months, really want to encourage people to participate in our democracy. We are fortunate enough to not live in a system of feudal lords like Westeros. We get to choose our leaders. We have an election coming up in November, and I just want to encourage everybody to make sure that you are registered to vote and to vote. And you can do so. You can check your registration at vote.org or headcount.org. It's very easy to put in your address and your name and find out whether you're set up or not. And that's important because a lot of states are changing their rules as far as their requirements for registration. And some people are being taken off the list without being aware of that. So I want to make sure that doesn't happen to you. And that's also, a lot of states have deadlines that are months out. So I want to make sure that everyone that is eligible to vote and wants to vote can do so. Go to vote.org or headcount.org to check your registration today.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We start off with the carnage of the twins continuing as the Hound makes his way out of the vicinity. Arya sees her brother riding a horse with a wolf head where his head used to be. Like I said, that visual is super fucked up, and all the visuals all around are great. Roose on top of the walls. I mean, that looks awesome. Mm-hmm. I didn't really expect to see the carnage. Like, there's really no reason to show it other than spectacle, which right. I'm cool with.
Yeah, no, I mean, they could have shown Arya and the Hound riding off. They could have just, the next time we see Frey and Bolton could have been there triumphant and as Walder's cleaning up his banquet facility. Mm-hmm. But it was nice seeing the scope of the battle. Like this, you know, a lot of times in Game of Thrones, they do a lot of tricks to make things look bigger than they are. But the scope of this battle is just as grand as the Blackwater. I mean, it didn't take up a full hour, but like they really do a good job of showing the just thousands and thousands of men being killed every which way.
Yeah.
Butchered, hung, burnt. And then Arya having to deal with that humiliation. Like, you know, we talked about how painful it was to watch her get so close to her family and then even so close to like letting Grey Wind unleash to do something and to see all that. And then her final scene, her final thought before, her final vision before she's forced to flee what should have been a happy family reunion is her brother's body being paraded around with his wolf's head sewn to it. It's, yeah, and like sewn is interesting because you can see like how kind of shoddily is done. Like the wolf's head's on a pike and it's strapped to Rob, and they've made some like really rough unit. It made it look, I think, even more fucked up. It's like something Guillermo del Toro would come up with, you know?
Right.
You know, just put some eyeballs in its palms, and you've got a Hellboy monster. So, it's great, and like the symbolism of the Stark banners burning. There's a little bit of like, I thought that they're going with like a hound being stymied by fire again, but that didn't really play out much. I had a memory of like Sandor having to slaughter his way out of here too.
No, he just picks up the banner and goes, and I thought maybe that was a little dangerous too.
I think I've conflated, because in the book there's like a fake out when Arya is at the scene. She sees a man riding her down with an axe, and then everything fades to black. And then that's the end of the chapter. And, you know, the way Game of Thrones books, you don't get back to Arya's point of view for, and you find out that that was the hound, and he smacked her with the side of his axe to knock her out and take her away because she wasn't having it. But like, I thought I remembered him having to kill a lot more dudes. But then again, I also could have gotten confused with the scene later on where he does, in fact, Darth Vader through a whole bunch of dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. Several of them. All right. We move on to Tyrion and Sansa. They're walking through the garden. People are laughing at Tyrion. He puts their name on a mental list of enemies, much like Arya has been doing, although he's not going to kill them. He's going to make him think that he's going to kill them. And Sansa suggests a couple of methods for getting back at them that aren't death. Podrick arrives to tell Tyrion that there's a small council meeting happening, and they head off.
Sheep shift him.
Yeah. Shifting, I guess, is shift is the word for sheep shit.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to.
Because they couldn't say shit in Game of Thrones. Like,
no, that's the joke, all right? The joke is that Sansa is so innocent that she thinks people are saying shift when it's really shit. She thinks that's a vulgar word for dung, so that's why there was like an amused look. And you know, we've been talking about especially in the spoiler section, people, you know, the like romanticize, let's say, this relationship. Okay. Man, and like, it's like, I promise you this isn't a spoiler. I know it might sound like it because I talk about it being a spoiler section and all that, but God help us, is Sansa flirting with Tyrion here?
Flirting? I don't know. Does anybody, is it flirting every time you tell a joke to someone that you could potentially be attracted to? Like,
I think when you mention pointedly with a wry look about your husband being a famous pervert, and like, I think that is approaching flirting, if you know. And it's tough because, like, again, what, Sansa's supposed to be 14 here. She doesn't even know the word for shit. Like, so I'm using that lightly, but like, she's definitely warming up to Tyrion.
Oh yeah.
And if not for her father's if not for Tyrion's father's foreign policy, you kind of do wonder, like, I don't know if it'd take a year or five, but I don't know. Maybe there would be a little Tyrion Sansa running around. I really like this scene. I like the clever dialogue. I love Tyrion's observation. Anyone named Desmond Crakehall has to be a pervert.
Yeah.
You know, them kind of like warming up to the idea that they're made for each other because he's the demon monkey and she's a disgraced daughter. They're like, literally, like, they would be the bad boys and girl of King's Landing if we could ever get some peace here. That'd be what People Magazine would talk about all the time. And then all the whole scene has got a little extra juice in it because Shay's in the background seething the whole time.
Yeah. And Tyrion's constantly looking over his shoulder like, is this okay? Like, right. how angry are you going to get here? Can I
Right.
Can I play this game with Sansa without, you know, crossing a line?
The answer is no.
Well, of course, that answer is always no with Shay.
Right, right. But no, it's a pretty good scene, and I one that I'd forgotten, to be honest, and I can see where a lot of people would be like, yeah, if you give some, like, a different set of circumstances and a different amount of years, that Sansa could do a hell of a lot worse than Tyrion Lannister.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, at his core, I think Tyrion is a pretty kind-hearted person.
Yeah.
And nothing like the rest of his family.
No, I mean, the fact that he's a man in this realm that's saying, like, I'm not going to rape my wife. He's already in pretty rarefied air, because most of the lords absolutely would, especially if it meant securing something like the wardenship of the North.
Mm-hmm.
So Tyrion in this universe, he's meeting the basic standards for 21st century decency, but he stands tall amongst his peers in this universe.
So we go to the small council meeting, where Tyrion finds out what happened to the twins. Joffrey wants to have Robb's head served to Sansa during his wedding feast, but everyone thinks he's an idiot. Tyrion threatens the king's life, to which Joffrey gets pissed, but Tywin puts him in his place and essentially sends him to bed without his supper, as Tyrion remarks. Everyone except Tyrion's dismissed, and then Tywin says he did all this to protect his family by ending the war, which Tyrion hopes that, you know, the North won't remember this. Tywin hopes they will, so that they won't fuck with him. And he also hopes that Tyrion will impregnate Sansa. And he gives this speech about how sacrifices have to be made for the family, which is exactly what he did when Tyrion was born and he let him live. And then Tyrion goes to Sansa, who has quite obviously heard the news about her brother, and he just bounces. He leaves her the fuck alone. That is right. Not the moment to get in there and try and convince her to bang.
No, or anything, honestly.
No, nothing. Nothing can be said.
Yeah, it's funny because we've been talking about the hypocrisy of Tywin. Like, you know, all the things that he preaches versus all the times he falls short. And I feel like that this isn't a great comeback to that whole line of thing. The fact that, like, oh well, I let you, this, you know, my grotesque son, live, and not only live but be, you know, I claimed you as a Lannister and all that. Like, that's the one sacrifice that he's made, and it makes up for all the other misery that he visits on his children and the kingdom at large. Mm-hmm. Did you find that persuasive?
Not particularly. No,
it was devastating to Tyrion and shut him up, though.
That was the intention. As is always the intention of Tywin, is to stick it to Tyrion, let him know how little affection he has for him.
Right.
It's always just to shit on Tyrion and to make a point. You know, I mean, he dual purposes his insults, certainly.
Right.
But they're definitely insults.
I know we talked about this season, but, like, Jack Leeson.
Oh, my God.
He is so, like, this performance shouldn't work. His, like, you've killed a puppy. Like, this should be widely lampooned. And if he was 1% less earnest, mm-hmm. it would fall the fuck apart. I'm just amazed. I'm just amazed at how good he is at being, like, this just amazing shit. And also there's this menace underneath it. Like, yeah, sure, Tywin's able to send him to bed now. But what the hell are they going to do with this guy?
Yeah,
like you want to laugh at him and not take him seriously, but in this universe, in that room, doing so could lead to just instant death, unless you're Tyrion Lannister and you can get away with it, because, you know, just how it would look.
Well, unless you're Tyrion Lannister and you have your daddy protecting you, essentially, like,
right?
Because I think if Tywin's not in that room, Tyrion might be killed or have his tongue cut out. You know.
It was really interesting, I thought, how the room reacted to Tyrion's monsters are dangerous and kings are dropping like flies, because the room kind of lets Joffrey twist, and he looks to his mom, he looks to Varys, he looks to Pycelle, he looks to old man Tywin, and no one is they're just like, ooh, I kind of want to see what happens here. I want to see whether this boy king can, like, defend himself at all. And then when he finally does, his grandfather weighs in with the, you know, no true king has to say that he's king.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to see people start taking sides, because, you know, Tywin has. But I mean, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of really subtle stuff here. Like, Varys's just face of disdain when, like, Joffrey has to say, "I'm the king," you know, like he knows this lesson better than anyone at the table. And he's just like, "Oh my God, unforced error. Mm-hmm. Not cool, man." Pycelle with his old fingers.
God, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The funny thing, like Joffrey, you know, shouting, "I am the king." And then, you know, Tywin saying any man who needs to say that is no true king. I'm also thinking when he shouts, "I am not tired." Any man who shouts, "I am not tired," must right. be tired. You're going to bed, Joffrey.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, Joff's only 14, too. And, like, the humiliation of your grandfather sending you off to bed when you're the king. And what are you going to... I mean, this is why I always think there's, like nah, I mean, I don't know. Tywin would have to really misplay his hand badly to have Joffrey ever give him the balance of power. Like, in this room right here, the Kingsguard are there. But nobody steps in and there's like, you know, no one puts our sire to bed against his leave. Like, everybody knows where the bread's buttered in this room.
Yeah.
How many years can he keep that? Like, but that's what it says. It seems like Tywin would have to consistently misplay his hand over the course of years to ever lose control to this boy king. And Joffrey, over those years, would either, you know, get religion or get got, I think. But no, I thought that was good. I also really liked the subplot of Tyrion realizing that his father's decisive moves, which we praised, in a certain kind of Machiavellian real politic way last season, like Tyrion can see the future and like, well, yeah, you've got 5-10 years left. We're going to be fighting your wars. We'll never pacify the North after what you've done. And half of the kingdoms are going to feel the same way. Like it's... you know, that's any kind of policy that essentially is scorched earth. You better utterly defeat those people and you better never need them again.
Yeah.
Because if any of those things are not true, you're just breeding an endless war.
And you got to keep your boot on their neck too. You know, I mean, right. but I think Tywin is fully prepared to do that. I think like Tywin's strategy works for Tywin. You know,
Tywin's prepared to let Roose Bolton do that.
sure. And whenever Tywin kicks the bucket, however many years from now, and Tyrion has to start fighting these wars, or Jaime or Cersei or Joffrey, whoever, then you're going to have problems because you're using the philosophy of a man who no longer exists and a man who doesn't have the same philosophies you hold. So,
yeah,
it's a dangerous thing long term. And that seems to be what Tywin is pushing for, right? Is that long-term effect for his family to raise their position.
I wonder if we're... Because, like, this scene kind of introduces, in my mind, the specter of Tywin rushing. Like, yes, this was a decisive blow against the North, and you did engineer it well, but, like, he's saying, with my few years left, I'm trying to forge this dynasty, right? Mm-hmm. Well... Like you said, this is short-term wise, long-term foolish. If Tywin had a sure thing 20 years ahead of him, if he's a younger man, I wonder if he makes these same plays because he's not a fool.
No, he's not.
But then again, Tywin also, like Tywin, his formative, the thing he made his bones on was the utter destruction of a rival house to his power in his own realm.
Yeah.
So like, you know, he learned that lesson. Like if, you know, if you're a hammer, all the world looks like nails. So maybe he's just like, I'm going to treat the North just like I did the Reigns of Castamere. And look how that turned out. I'll have a new song about the wolves of Winterfell or some bullshit that I can play at my sons and daughters can play at their red weddings. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's what's so great about Game of Thrones is there's enough of our real world understanding and history in it that you can see. You can applaud like the brilliant short term strategies and tactics, but also be like, ooh, yeah, but in the real world, and Game of Thrones tries to be a real world. This is problematic, and the characters themselves are realizing it too.
Yeah, at least the smart ones are. I don't think Cersei has.
No. Although Cersei's smart enough to know that they're going to be fighting for a long time.
That's true.
I mean, Tyrion's able to give her that lesson. Where like, yeah, it's beyond Joffrey.
All right, we go to Mira, who has scouted an empty castle on the wall, which they hunker down in. Bran tells scary stories about a man who was turned into a rat for violating the guest right. I think that's what it's called. Just killing someone who they've taken into their house. These next few scenes kind of just naturally flow into each other, which I really love. this one, you know, we talk about violating the guest right, and then we go right to Roose Bolton.
Smash cut Roose right Bolton to scene. Roose and,
you know, he's talking about what happened to Theon, and then we go right into Ramsay eating the sausage. It's it's a really nice flow to it over these next few minutes.
Yeah, it's almost like Archer, right? Like where the last word of the scene introduces it's the first word of the next scene. Uh-huh. Like, I mean, it's not funny, but it's very much like bang, 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 smash cut, smash cut, smash cut.
That sausage scene is pretty funny.
The sausage scene, funny. Almost inappropriately so, but yeah, like that thing is one of the most, that's the probably most famous GIF sequence that came out of this season.
Yeah.
Ramsay holding it up and doing the little,
the jiggle,
the sausage wiggle. Yeah. The phantom itch.
So good. So anything to say about this Mira scene? The Hodor echo was awesome. I love that.
Yeah, I got the echoing of Hodor, and it's cool to see the Night Fort. Of course, the Night Fort's been built up because, you know, Sam gave us a bunch of data dump about it, and here's Bran talking about its cursed nature, and these old stories, tales they told about it, and there's fresh blood. It's very creepy and menacing, but really its sole point is it's efficient because it's to introduce the next scene and kind of like for people that maybe not be book readers or not steep in the lore, like they've done a lot of heavy lifting these last three episodes would be like this. I'm trying to think of what would be similarly shocking. Let's say that, like, I don't know, North Korea hosted a diplomatic summit with the United States and South Korea and Japan, and while they're over there, they killed the entire diplomatic staff, including the Secretary of State. Like it'd be that kind of beyond the pale. Like you fucking killed ambassadors, and this is poison. The reason the gods hate it is probably because, like, if you cannot discuss important matters under flags of truce and in rival lords' halls, then the mechanism that society functions on completely breaks down.
Sure,
it's the same reason. War. Same reason one of the government's prime, historically has been it's one of its prime functions is enforce contracts and the law, because if you don't have that, and this is kind of like, this is what you need to discuss those of, this is the foundation you need to discuss those other things. So gods hate it. You can debate whether the gods really hate it, or it's one of those things where, like, you know, the gods said they hate it because we need it. We need everyone to believe in it. But yeah, they're just hammering a home that this is beyond the pale. Every child in Westeros knows you fucking don't kill people that have taken sanctuary underneath the roof.
Yeah, and it has the whole feel of like a ghost story to it. I love them sitting around the fire, you know, talking like this is scary stories to tell in the dark or something.
Yeah.
Like it's got a real good feeling to it, which comes back later when Sam shows up and they kind of do the scary ghost in the darkness. They think it's the Rat King, you know?
Right.
Real good. So yeah, like I said, we smash cut over to Walder Frey gloating over his recent victory. Roose and Frey congratulate each other, and then Frey asks him what happened at Winterfell. Roose says his bastard Ramsay captured Theon after Robb offered them amnesty if they handed him over, and now he's doing his thing with Theon, and they've just kind of said, well, Robb's dead, so we're not going to honor that agreement at all. And they couldn't deliver Theon, you know, Ramsay had to go get him. So,
right. This is a nice little efficient scene that lets us know a couple of things. The Blackfish has escaped. Mm-hmm. And this entire season has told us that the Blackfish is a man to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an army. He doesn't. But if he ever found one, holy. And Roose is, you know, Roose is the brains of this operation, right?
Sure.
So the fact that he, like, you know, he's trying to warn Frey and Frey doesn't give a shit, and Roose is like, as you say. And then, like, just the how Frey is just obsessed with all these slights that he's and Roose is turning his mind to more serious things about, you know, whether he should move to Winterfell and how he's gonna pass, you know, Roose is a Northman. He knows how much the people love the Starks. He knows what a shit he's been, and he's going to have to try to rule over this land. It's the biggest land area. It's like the North is as big as the other six kingdoms combined.
Yeah.
And he has shit on the people who have popularly ruled over this place for millennia. He has violated the most sacred social norm. How the fuck do you govern? How do you fuck do you govern?
Yeah, no, it's going to be hard. Luckily, the North has no more armies left.
Right,
well,
yeah.
There are pockets. There are pockets.
Right.
But
I bet there's lots of Boltons. Lots of Boltons.
Yeah, yeah, probably lots of Boltons. Probably lots of support from, you know, Tywin Lannister. He's in a pretty good position as far as military might positions go. But you're right. He's not. He does not have the will of the people, certainly.
Right.
So I don't know. We'll see how it goes for him. I definitely get the feeling that Roos is sort of humoring Frey in this scene, but not entirely. I also think he is a little bit reveling in the victory they just scored.
Yeah.
There's something in his demeanor that's like halfway between humoring an old stupid man and knowing, hey, we just did an awesome thing here.
I think he's feeling him out. Like, how much of an alliance do I want to, like, this was an alliance of convenience, and we're all smart for taking it, but, oh, right, Walder Frey's an asshole.
Yeah.
And a stupid one at that. Like, it's kind of like that, Roos kind of distancing himself, like, you know, being polite and all that, and being secretly pleased with himself, but also thinking this man's a fool.
Sure.
And just lucked into this situation.
Okay, so the next scene, Ramsay eats a pork sausage while he taunts Theon about his dismembered member. Theon begs for death, but Ramsay says they need him alive. And Ramsay gives him a new name, Reek.
Yeah.
About this scene? It's excellent.
Yeah, it's another torture scene. It brings us up to seven scenes of torture in 10 episodes worth of content. This is the, and it all is to serve this, like, it's a Kunta Kinte moment, right? It's where you like if you want to show a character being utterly broken by a captor, you give them a new name and you force them to internalize it, right?
Sure.
Which is why it's effective. When he gets to this point, and you can see that there's still a little bit of Theon left, but, you know, what do you do? What do you do? You're strapped to a cross, and a guy's just going to just continue to beat the piss out of you. It's going to get worse and worse until you say what they want. Like, I want to say I don't know what that does to a person, but we do know what it does to a person. We know what pervasive psychological and physical torture does to people. It dehumanizes them and breaks them down to this level. And that's what all this has led up to. The fact that this, you're supposed to understand that this man is no longer Theon Greyjoy, which serves to, like, the scene we sit with the Greyjoys kind of debating what to do, like that adds juice to that. But, like, all of this torture has come down to this, that Ramsay has broken this man down and turned him into something subhuman.
Yeah, my touchstone for this concept of breaking someone down and forcing them to think a certain way is that episode of Star Trek where the Cardassians capture Picard and force him to say, there are four lights.
That would have been a much more, that'd be a better analogy for me to make rather than LeVar Burton's performance of Kunta Kinte. that would have been safer and more appropriate territory for me to trot on.
That's
so,
just
yeah.
where my mind goes. That is indelibly ingrained in my brain, apparently.
There are four lights.
All right, Bran and company wake up to the sounds of someone approaching. It gets all spooky, but it turns out to be just Sam and Gilly. Sam realizes that Bran is Jon's brother and offers to help. Bran wants to go north, but Sam wants him to meet up with Jon at Castle Black. So Jojen steps in and says, hey, I saw the Army of the Dead. They have to go north because we got to stop them. We're the only ones who can.
Yeah. And that's like, this is a great scene because there's a part of Bran that you believe wants to go with this man who's like, you're my brother just as much as you're. And like, I'm a man of the Night's Watch, and I know your brother, and I'm familiar with direwolves, and I know about Hodor, and I love Hodor's reaction to being famous.
Yeah,
like he's Night's Watch famous. I love all that, and there's this like kind of hopeful moment, and then Bran realizes, nah, that's not what I'm meant to do. And also, the same moment in inverse with Sam realizes, like, oh, you're going to stop the White Walkers. Like, how utterly foolish! It looks like some damn child's crusade.
Yeah.
But what do you do?
And Bran is right on the edge. I mean, most of the time that we've seen Bran, he's been kind of on the edge of, am I going to follow this supposed destiny that I have, that this weird creep from the woods is telling me all about? And, you know, my brain is kind of telling me this is the right path too, or am I going to follow all logic and all reason and the comfortable thing, you know, to go back to my family, to be reunited with them?
Yeah, I mean, these last few episodes, like, Bran's really grown up, right? And, like, up until now, it's still been like, oh, these are ghost stories old Nan and Asha are trying to scare me with. But now you've got this guy who's like, no, I just been up there, and it's bad, and I had to kill one of these fuckers, and it was all I could do to do it. Mm-hmm. And there's thousands more, and 10 times that many's dead been. And yet Bran, by faith, essentially, and Jojen's green seeing, decides, nah, I'm gonna keep on keeping on. He, like I said, this is the, I think, the scene where he grows up.
Yeah. Okay, then we get a message from Ramsay delivered to Balon Greyjoy that tells them to retreat to the Iron Islands or be killed. He also delivers a box with Theon's cock in it and says more Theon will follow if they don't leave the North. Balon decides not to retreat over Yara's protests, and she makes a decision too. She's going to take the fastest ship in the fleet and 50 men, and she's going to go save him.
Yeah, that's a cool moment when, like, her dad turns into a fucking total asshole, and
kind of pathetic, like, too. Like, I look at Balon's reaction to this, and he stands in front of Yara, and he says, like, reason after reason. Like, he's trying to justify it not only to her, but to himself. Like, oh, you know, he's an idiot. He betrayed us. He, like,
doesn't have a cock anymore.
Doesn't have a cock. He's not a man. He can't further the bloodline. Like, all of the reasons that he's giving are reasons that don't matter to Yara, right?
Yeah.
And he can see that on her face, right? Yeah. And he knows. I think he feels some shame in this moment, like,
oh, yeah,
for not supporting Theon. But, you know, he is a little bit cowardly in that way.
There's a lot of symmetry between this and Davos pleading for Gendry, right? Like, you know, all these reasons why you should versus the one reason why you shouldn't, which is because it's not the right thing to do. And that's essentially what Yara is saying as well.
Yeah, it kind of makes those people look a little pathetic. Honestly.
And also, like, she knows she's got the moral high ground, because the king could just be like, fuck you, you're not going to take the best. But she knows, like, right, I've got the moral high ground here, and there's nothing you can do to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know that Balon thinks he could either. Like, maybe he could kill her right there, but if she walks out the hall and says, hey, I want the best ship and the 50 best men to go free the heir to, you know, the Iron Islands, who's with me? There's nothing, like, the Ironborn are a little bit more democratic than most Westerosi institutions. So the fact that she's got a head of steam and the men respect her is a powerful position to be in. And she's going to use it to save her brother. Fuck what Balon thinks.
And I think if he tries to say, no, you can't have a ship, no, you can't have 50 men, she's just going to go herself.
Yeah.
Like, that's the determination on her face in that moment. I will do this. Give me the tools I need. Otherwise, I'm doing it myself and I'm going to get killed.
And what would Balon do if his daughter showed him up in terms of courage? Like, you know, he could do that calculus.
Sure. Another really strong scene, I thought.
Yep.
So we move on to Sam showing Bran's group the dragonglass that he found, and he explains that it kills White Walkers, which they're all on board with. He warns Bran that there are many more dead men walking in the north, but they part ways with Sam and Gilly, and they head north.
Yeah, the whole "I wish you'd come with us," "I wish I could." It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and I like the visual of them walking down through the tunnel in the wall.
Yeah,
it's nice. It almost looks like the vision of death that most people have, right, where they're walking toward the light.
Yeah, heading towards the light.
Yeah, hopefully that's a good omen.
Thought we got a little robbed because the scene, like this gate. Because that's the thing, is like, you know, Sam talked about how all these gates are like frozen shut with rubble and stone that they've been abandoned. I mean, this looks like a giant fucking tunnel. Mm-hmm. And the books is just this like really narrow little door that's like magical weirwood thing that like grows slightly larger to admit men of the Night's Watch through it. I don't know. I felt like that one of the mission statements of the Double D's are we're going to really shy away from magic.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's vital to the plot, because we know what people are here for and we don't want to wear that. Plus, we also don't want to spend the $100,000 it would take to make that thing happen. But
sure.
I do wish there's some budget for better CGI wolves and the weirwood door that guards the secret tunnel at the Nightfort.
I did think the wolf was fine in this episode.
Yeah, no, he wasn't actively mauling people either. So
that's true. He was just standing there and walking around,
being a badass.
Yep. All right. Davos visits Gendry in a cell, who has lumped him in with Melisandre, Stannis, and the other Highborns. Davos ingratiates himself to the skeptical Gendry by explaining where the shit flow of King's Landing, where in the shit flow of King's Landing he grew up, which is Gin Alley. Gendry asks why he accepted lordship. Davos says he did it so his son could have a better life, but his son died because he followed Davos. It's
yeah, tragic. I love that whole, I was born in Gin Alley. Streets of steel, you're middle class, son. Uh-huh. Get the fuck out of here.
Fancy
with this
part of town.
Highborn stuff, yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Then also the fact that like Davos is humble enough to be like, yeah, I mean, I did all this and I'm rubbing. Like, that's the other thing. Like, Gendry let himself get talked into this Highborn shit and he got a leeched, and Davos let himself get talked into it and his son died.
Yeah.
Because of Davos. And I think that's another thing that like kind of humanizes him and makes, you know, his lack of arrogance and his like bonding over like, yeah, we I'm a knight and I'm a sir, but I still get jobbed by these rich folk, mm-hmm. by these blue bloods. That's what really cements their bond. And of course, freeing him from certain death doesn't hurt either.
Sure. It definitely makes Davos a more sympathetic character, too. Like, he kind of always is. I just get good feelings when I think about Davos, right? He's the guy trying to do the right thing. He comes from nothing, essentially. He's very reluctant to claim this power, which I feel is, like, what a good leader should be, is not power hungry. That's very much not Davos. I don't know. I just like Davos as a human being.
Right.
All right. Next scene is Varys trying to convince Shay to leave. He's bonding with her over their foreigner status. And once that's done, he gives her diamonds and says, sail away from here because she's endangering the life of the one man who might be able to save the country. Shay throws the diamonds on the ground and tells Varys that if Tyrion wants her to leave, he can tell her himself. Hasn't he already done this?
Oh no, for sure.
When she says this, I shout at the screen, "He has, you dummy!
Yeah,
just leave. That's the play here."
Yeah, and the fact that she's, because I don't buy for a minute that Tyrion put Varys up to this.
I think Varys. No, I don't think so.
I think Varys is doing what he's doing. He's trying to serve the realm, and he sees Tyrion as a really important piece, and he can't be distracted or taken off the board just for her dumb ass.
Yeah.
And she, God damn it, Shay. God damn it. I mean, I don't have anything against Shay. And I like this scene. Like I said, this is the best scene because it's the one that I think convinces me that she does love Tyrion, that this is like some kind of genuine shit. I don't think they've earned it. I don't think they've told that story well, but in this moment, I believe it because, you know, that's what's being asserted here by Varys, who's a smart guy. It takes fucking all of Varys's authority and weight to make me believe that Shay might love Tyrion, but she loves him the way like a dysfunctional, crazy, you know, quote unquote, like she loves him the way a girl that sets a man's, car on fire because she suspects him of cheating loves him. Like it's dangerous and destructive and codependent and hopeless and, you know, very like stupid Romeo and Juliet, which is saying something because Romeo and Juliet is pretty stupid. So what'd you think?
She loves him the way that Jaime loves Cersei.
No, and it's like, that's the other thing, is like you realize these are all children. This woman's been raped on a semi-daily basis since she's 9 years old. She was traded over here at 13 to be a pleasure servant. I mean, it's, she comes by all this pathos, honestly. It's liable to destroy Tyrion. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't like Shay. I don't like the storyline. I don't think it was very well executed, but this is the pinnacle. This right here.
Yeah, and there's a moment in the scene where you think she might be getting the point. She might be finally understanding. And because Varys being a third party to this, I think is able to cut through some of the passion and the emotion in the situation really start to get it into her head that this is a very bad thing, not only for you, not only for Tyrion, but more importantly, for everyone, for the realm. Like, we're trying to do something so much bigger than your little tryst here, so get the fuck out of the way. He says it much nicer than that, and he almost cuts through, but not quite.
And similar to the way, like, Davos bonded with Gendry, he says to say, like, look, I know you because I am you. Yeah. And I know what I'm asking you to do. I'm asking you to go to a faraway place and live a life of comfort and watch the man you love be, like, this heroic figure, or maybe die a martyr's death, and you're going to be nothing to him. You're going to be the person that took off. And, like, in fact, he'll probably assume the worst about you. Mm-hmm. He's offering her a chance to be a pate, but why would she? Like, she's not from this country. She doesn't give a shit. She just cares about Tyrion. And from, like, you know, like she says, why doesn't Tyrion, why don't we both take these diamonds and go off and be comfortable? Why does he have to be here?
Yeah.
I mean, but that's so tropey. The woman that's, like, trying to hold the man back, you know, it's like every fucking boxer's girlfriend ever. It's Rocky mm-hmm. Balboa's wife, you know. It's this is wet blanket shit. I don't care for it.
Yeah, it does, I guess, make the possibility of them running off together more possible. You know, like this bag of diamonds, the thing that could give them wealth where Tyrion wouldn't have to go juggle or be you know, some kind of joke. He could just live his life in relative comfort.
Yeah, and like, but the thing is like, that's, I guess, the, now that you said that, like, Tyrion could do that. Tyrion could run off with his weight in gold and do the same thing. Yeah. He knows that, right? But he doesn't do it. Yeah. And what Shay doesn't know is if she ran off with Varys's diamonds and Tyrion, Varys, you'll come back to Westeros 10 years later in a fucking box. You're not going to do Varys that way. You're not going to fucking do Varys that way.
Cut off his sack of diamonds and...
Yeah, exactly. He'll end up back in the box. Yeah, he'll get them diamonds back.
All right, Tyrion gets Podrick very drunk, but more drunk than Podrick is comfortable with, until Cersei shows up and tells him to leave. She tries to convince Tyrion to give Sansa a child so she can have a tiny bit of happiness in her life. And she tells this, you know, the story about Joffrey being born, how he's such a happy baby, and it was the only thing that kept her from throwing herself off the Red Keep. It's a very good scene. I like it a lot.
That's how Joff will be known in history books. Joffrey the Jolly. That's definitely how,
as long as he
remembered.
Gets to write the history book, sure.
Right. And you know, it's like, there's like, I think a realization to Cersei that, like, well, this kid started off okay. Mm-hmm. Me and Robert ruined him
pretty much.
Like yeah. There she's self-aware enough to kind of realize that. And then you get to that dark place, and then Tyrion starts talking about their father's foreign policy and how, mm-hmm. you know, when will this be over? When the wars are over? But every time we defeat an enemy, we create two more. Well, this is going to go on for quite some time. But you know, that's the thing, is like Cersei, I find it much easier to pity because, like, I think she does try to play the game. It's just that she doesn't have very good plays by mm-hmm. virtue of being a woman. And by virtue of being the, you know, married to Robert and now being the queen, she doesn't have a lot of a great place. I guess she could do the Tyrion, her and Jaime could both do the Tyrion Shay thing and take their weight in gold and go off to Essos and start a new life. But they're trapped. Oh, I mean, Cersei, to the point was like, if it wasn't for my children, I'd have thrown myself off a tower. That's fucked up, man.
It is. Can you imagine what Tywin's reaction would be if Jaime and Cersei stole a bunch of gold and were never heard from again?
I don't know.
Son he's left with is Tyrion.
Tywin could afford a lot of faceless men. Like, I don't know that I like their chances. Although Tyrion's pretty smart. Tyrion's pretty, like, if anyone is going to evade a Tyrion or a Tywin banked death note, it'd be Tyrion Lannister. Mm.
Okay, Arya and the Hound ride past a group of men who are bragging about being the one. Well, one of the guys is bragging about being the one who sewed the wolf's head onto Rob. Arya dismounts and stabs the man to death, and the Hound has to deal with the other three. And he does.
He easily does. He's a fucking monster.
My favorite part of this scene, though, is the very, very end, right before they cut. You can see the Hound digging into the food mm-hmm. of the men he's just killed.
Sure.
I love it. He sits down and starts eating some chicken.
Yeah, he's a practical brigand, and he's got a penchant for the chicken. I don't know why, but I love every time the Hound is a killer. there's something like mythic to it, the way they film it and how like just big and lanky Rory is, and just how imposing, and just how, I mean, he doesn't just stab dudes, he like cuts them in twain. It's ridiculous. It's like Darth Vader in that hallway full of rebels and First Contact or whatever the hell. Rebel Assault. Yep. Yes.
That Star Trek movie. Yeah.
Yes.
Darth Vader when he cuts
the courtship
those...
of Princess Leia. When he was going down and mowing people down in the hallway, it's kind of how I feel about the Hound, and not even the Mountain. The Mountain's always doing stupid shit like gutting dudes and cutting horse heads off, but like you never see him. The Hound's got some kind of weird grace about him. I like watching a man killing dudes that deserve to be killed. But Arya, what do you think of Arya's first, like her first flipping or switching to murder girl mode? I know she's killed a boy, and that's like the pointed, yeah, it's the first man I've killed. But it's that, I don't know, kind of like bittersweet. It's sweet she's killing people, like sweet, but it's bitter because she's like 11 years old.
Yeah. You hate to see it, but you love to watch it, you know?
Right.
But also, she's very sloppy. She's very sloppy. Like, I mean, the Hound's not there. She's dead. You know,
and I don't think she. I mean, I think this is a death. This is a suicide by Frey attempt.
Yeah, for sure.
That the Hound stops just because he's a fucking badass.
Right.
But there's a lot of going on in the hood there. Like the fact that she's, you know, this 11-year-old girl who dreamed of being a great warrior, who probably never would have given the chance, you know, barring these series of unfortunate events that she's lemony snicketed her way into, but. Now she's a butcher, which is not what she really wanted to be, and wanting to die on top of that. And the fact that she stole the Hound's knife in a slick enough way that he didn't even know kind of also belies some of the badass smack that he's been talking about. Like, oh, just try it, girl. Like, she could have opened you up and you would have never even known it. So yeah. You're starting to just the myth of Arya starting to build.
Sneaky.
Both
Sneaky
good and
Arya.
Bad, yeah.
All right, Ygritte catches up with Jon, and she aims an arrow at him. Jon says, look, I didn't have a choice to do the things I did, and he tells her that they both love each other, obviously, but he's got to go home. So he turns to leave, and she puts an arrow in him, and then two more as he rides off. She's not kidding with the you-know-nothing Jon Snow.
Yeah, yeah. She should have said, you won't kill me. That'd been at, but you won't hurt me. That's an incorrect statement, Jon Snow.
Absolutely.
This is the think like this is the thinking man's Romeo and Juliet, right?
All right. Like,
If you want to do star-crossed lovers, this is a good way to do it. Like, I love everything about and like the fact that like Jon says, she like that you've known the whole time. You've known exactly that I have not changed and I'm the same guy and you love me for it and I love you. And just kind of like, you know, this is a better version of Tyrion and Shay because Jon could have said, come with me and you can defect and we can, you know, whatever. And she's like, come with like either one of them. All you have to do to be happy with the one you love is give up every other ideal you have. It's
sure.
So easy.
So easy.
But it's it, yeah, and it's they wrestle with it, and she fucking, like, Jon Snow could die. I mean, obviously, I don't think she's trying to kill him, but it's great. It's great. I love it. And also, I felt like, you know, she's grief-stricken, but also, like, the fact that she's sending him home with a couple arrows is kind of, like, allowing him to go home with honor. You know, like, there'll be so many questions about, oh, you killed Karin half-hand and you've been sleeping with the enemy and all, but, like, the fact that, you know, she put half a quiver full of arrows in him, I wonder how much of that is, like, going through her head, too. Like, she's trying to help him make it look good.
And I think
for her as well, too, I guess.
That's the thing. Like, I think it helps her retain her own identity or her own sense of identity as well.
Yeah.
As a wildling, free folk.
The thing that's so great about it is neither one of them feel like they have what's the upper hand. Like, they're both stubborn. They're both not going to, you know, they're not going to give up their ideals for each other. They've been living a fantasy and a dream, but it still hurts.
Yeah.
It's great.
It is. All right. Sam arrives at Castle Black where he meets with Maester Aemon. It's Aemon, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Aemon.
Yeah. Maester assumes that the baby is Sam's, but Sam sets him straight. claiming that he remembers every word of his oath, every single one, which also happens to cover the wildlings as much as anyone. Mm-hmm. So Aemon decides to let Gilly and the baby stay for the time being. Then he has Sam apparently write 44 consecutive letters to be sent that night. That's a lot of writing.
Mm.
Sam did not get into the Night's Watch to write 44 letters.
Forget the Valyrian steel. Sam would trade his a giant fortune for the invention of carbon paper.
Right, carbon paper. The printing press. I mean, just if you're going to get an invention.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been stuck in the Middle Ages for 8,000 years. What the fuck? Can I get some movable type in here? Can I get a Gutenberg? Can
we
I get
the technology?
Forget Valyrian steel. We need a movable type set press. I'm tired of this. My hands are crampy.
Make the letters out of Valyrian steel if you really want to.
Right. Yeah. You only have to make one set. That's good. It's good. And like this whole like the dawning of Sam realizing, and it's him and John both are kind of having this realization that these people that they've been at bitter war with their entire lives and have hated, they're just people. Compared to the monsters that they're facing.
Right. That's the big game changer here, for lack of a better word, is the White Walkers. And, you know, protecting the realms of men very much applies to the men, you know, and women and children and everything up north beyond the wall. Mm-hmm. So I agree with Sam. Apparently, Aemon does as well.
It'll be interesting to see. We see the reaction to Stannis, I think you're supposed to wonder, like, what kind of, like, this is given the full weight of the triumphant Game of Thrones music, the same shit that plays when Yara is given that badass speech about the 50 best murderers and the Iron Islands. And you're like, I wonder, like, we saw in previous seasons that the King's Landing and the, you know, the Southrons broadly just don't give a shit about the wall. And they think that the Lord Commander's up there prone to exaggeration and begging for funds and men. Like, you wonder how serious will be taken, or the opposite. Like, what if Stannis and Joffrey and Roose, like what if, like, all the different claimants all show up at the wall because they're like, okay, I mean, he sent it to 44 great houses. Like, that would be just as big as a problem if no one shows up or one shows up, you know? What will happen?
I don't know. They would probably end up slaughtering each other before the White Walkers even got there, and then nobody to defend the realm. So
quite a full table the Double D's are setting for next season.
Yeah, I like it. All right, we go to Davos, who's reading letters, which are super boring. Shireen suggests reading her much more interesting books, but Davos is trying to stay informed on the happenings of Westeros, which he does successfully when he reads a note, presumably from Maester Aemon, about the White Walkers. And he goes to the war room, where Melisandre is pretty smug about her god killing Robb Stark. Davos does not want to take the throne with magic, but Stannis says he will use whatever means necessary. And in this case, it's the red magic. Melisandre claims that they must burn Gendry to claim the throne, and Stannis agrees. So Davos goes and frees Gendry and sends him away in a rowboat.
I thought it was a nice touch to have the bells tolling for Robb, because, like, the bells usually toll for, you know, we found that for important births, important deaths. And, like, I felt like it's a sign of, like, a measure of respect that Stannis had for someone he would absolutely kill as an usurper. But that's Stannis, right? Like, grateful to Davos, give him a knighthood, but also cut his fingers off because he's a thief. Robb, usurper, you know, trying to take his position as rightful king, but, you know, also good warrior. I liked his dad, so we'll ring the bells for him. I like that little note that they give of the Stannis being complicated. But yeah, fucking Mel, the smugger she is, the more I hate her.
Yeah, no, yeah. When she takes credit for Robb's death, I'm like, coincidence, lady, come on.
I mean, you and I would say that, but, like, what would Stannis say when he just literally threw the leeches on the flame and almost miraculously, like, no, you know, like, the fact, because I wonder if it's even thought, like who starts to put together who greased what wheels, you know, what, like, I think it's going to be pretty clear when people start getting their rewards that, like, who's greasing the wheels. But, like, I wonder, I mean, Stannis is pretty smart. And I don't think Davos' line of attack goes unnoticed. Like, I think that Stannis is willing to admit that, like, okay, yeah, I burnt the leech, King died. Should I be thanking the Red God or Tywin Lannister?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Pretty easy to thank the Red God when the Red Woman is in the room.
I do think that Davos's plea that you can't win using blood magic is particularly weak, and Stannis really rhetorically hands him his ass. Like, yeah, well, yeah, you know, this thing was conquered by dragons, and dragons are magic. And the fact is, I'm the king. The realm needs me, and I will use whatever arms I've got. You know. Mm-hmm. I'll go full fucking nuclear if I have to, which is historically been Melisandre's vagina.
And Davos's only recourse is to go outside of the structure here, you know, and go free Gendry by himself.
Yeah.
And hope that, you know, his argument later about you'll need me will prevail.
I love the little line between Davos and Gendry where Gendry is like, is this some kind of trick? And Davos is like, yes, but not on you. I think Davos... I mean, it's a toss-up between Davos and Tyrion, who my favorite character is.
Yeah, Davos is so good.
He's so good, and Liam, what is his name, Cunningham? Embodies him effortlessly with this, like, kind of charm and warmth, and, like, you can tell he's a deeply ignorant man, but he's also very wise.
Yeah.
Because he's been able to see this game from both sides, and, you know, he's appropriately skeptical of authority and power and zeal and... an appropriate respect for the weight of his office. I just, yeah, he's good. He's good. He's sure the is. People's Tyrion.
All right. John barely makes it back to Castle Black alive, and he collapses outside the gate, and the men bring him inside.
Oh, he falls on his arrows.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I always notice that. Like when you get your arrow sticking out your back and you fall on your back, like, oh my God,
it's gotta hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like fall on your stomach, man. Like, yee-ha.
Mm-hmm.
Not good.
There's a good moment here with when Sam sees him.
Yes.
You know, I think Sam never expected to see John alive again.
Right.
So this is a pleasant surprise from him, and it's all over his face, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Then Jaime arrives in King's Landing, where he gets a small taste of what it's like to be a commoner, at least that is until he reaches Cersei. Cersei's reaction here to Jaime.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean... I think, much like Sam with John, she kind of didn't expect to ever see Jaime again.
Yeah, and it's like, so I had a different reaction. I was thinking that my notes say, poor Jaime, this fool actually loves Cersei. And Cersei loves a particular image of Jaime. Like,
and it's not the shit covered one that without a hand.
That's lame and limping, like... You know, she has always fantasized that they are the same, right? And now that it's like, it's like the mirror or the picture of Dorian Gray. Like, well, shit, look how bad the reflection in the mirror is looking. It's not cool. Like, Jaime is accumulating all of the sins that we jointly commit. I don't know. There was some kind of hesitation about it. Wasn't like, oh my, it wasn't like a ghost walked into a door. It's almost like, this is what I wanted, but now that I've got it,
Yeah, that's definitely in there. It's that, and I also think there's a bit of, like, I got so wrapped up in the shit that's happening in King's Landing that I kind of forgot about you for a while.
Right.
You know, I think she's very much got her head in a certain place with the weddings that are happening, the Machiavellian maneuverings. All that has kind of taken the place of Jaime in her mind.
Yeah.
Now Jaime's back, and it's almost a shock to her in that way.
Right.
So Davos comes clean to Stannis about freeing Gendry, and Stannis sentences him to death. But as the Hand of the King, Davos advises him real quickly about against killing him, essentially, because there's a shit storm coming from the north, and Stannis is going to need him. And Melisandre does an about face here with her tune. Tell Stannis that the only war which matters is the one coming from the north, and they need to head north.
It's interesting. It's an interesting take on Melisandre, right?
Like, and I think Stannis realized it too, right? He turns around when she says, we got to go north. It's the only war that matters. He turns around. He's like, bitch, you just were preaching this other message two seconds ago.
Right. And like, this is the scene that starts to make you think that Melisandre isn't just a naked opportunist. I mean, or clothed opportunist, depending on the scene she's in. She's like this is the scene that I think makes you think that she's, because before this, I remember in the books and the TV show, I'm like, well, she's just a charlatan. She has happened the road to the right island at the right time. She's hitching her star to this guy's wagon. She's full of trick. But like the fact that she's like, you know what? Let's abandon this Game of Thrones and go to this thing that everyone else in the realm thinks is a bunch of bullshit. Like, I think that she's got questionable tactics, and her faith makes her do fucked up things. But I do think that she believes herself as a force for good, and not just like, I want to be the woman behind the man. You know, like, I think she's actually trying to do good here. And like, you can see in the confusion in Davos' face too.
I have a different read on it. Like, when Davos comes in there and he very much convinces Stannis that this is a huge problem, she switches her tune because it becomes apparent that Stannis is going to let him live and is actually potentially believing Davos and is maybe about to go move against her.
I think Stannis was like, nah, he was going to, my read in a situation, he was absolutely going to kill Davos because like, I was gave you clemency before because I'm soft-hearted towards my daughter, and I also do like, but now you've defied me a second time, and I think if Melisandre hadn't piped up, like, so you think that she was just seeing which way the winds are blowing and go and tacking that way. I think she actually is the thing that changed the wind. I'd say it'd be interesting to see what people think, but this is the last podcast we're doing on this, so...
Right.
Not for too long. We'll be back. We'll definitely... I don't know if we talked about it for sure, but we'll be back sometime in November. I'm not sure which combinations of us. I think, you know, Jim, you might be back for some of them, but there's going to be a lot of, like, deep dives into the new Targaryen historical book that's coming out. Me and Anthony's book on the Gods of Thrones are going to be coming out at the same time. So we'll be doing two or three, maybe four episodes in November. Also, we got the release date. We know for a fact that Game of Thrones Season 8 is coming back in April, which is exciting. So... we will be going away, but not nearly as long as we have been in the recent past.
All right, final scene. Dany waits outside the gates to see if she'll be welcomed in by the slaves who she's liberated. The slaves meet her, and she tells them that she cannot give them their freedom because it's not hers to give, only theirs. And they begin chanting Misa, which means mother. So Dany comes down off her pedestal to walk among them, and they welcome her by raising her into the air as they continue to chant Misa. They have definitely, I would say at this point, accepted her.
Yes. Yes. They've accepted her as all the other, slaves in her formerly slave army, freeman army now have, you know, and there's the fact that I don't know. I kind of thought it was bullshit that they were playing with the whole, like, oh, will they or won't they kind of, and then, you know, like the people approach and the Unsullied, like, spear up and all that stuff.
I'm with you, because we saw a group of them already accept her, right? Those soldiers who were slaves put their arms down and didn't fight Jorah and Euro trash Daria. So, yeah, we kind of already expected that they would.
I guess the question is, like, are they willing to... because, like, you know, Dany is like, I'm not freeing you. You're freeing yourselves, and you have to choose what you're going to do from here on. And, like, I guess the question is, are they going to be like, thanks, but now, like, keep working your way down Slaver's Bay? Are they going to be capable of... I don't know. Like, there was something there that they're trying for, and I wasn't quite sure they got. The other thing about, like, a contemporary analysis of this scene, there was a lot of criticism about... the, like, white savior complex that, like, Dany is the latest manifestation of that. And if you're not familiar with this, the way of thinking, like, there are people of continents such as South America, Africa, and India, et cetera, that have had a whole long history of colonialism and slaves and slavery and warfare. And then for hundreds and hundreds of years, these outside influences were fucking with them. And then they endure a century of the white men, the white man's burden of educating these savages and pulling them out of their own misery, which was largely created by the white man. And there's a lot of sensitivity amongst those communities to a white woman with platinum blonde hair crowd surfing in a sea of brown people. Mm-hmm. I don't think the showrunners, I mean, like, you know, it's like things move fast nowadays. And 5 years ago, like, I don't think the showrunners knew what they were stepping into. In fact, I think they would be the ones that be like, well, if you actually look, our crowd's pretty cosmopolitan. There's white people, European people, people from Caribbean descent, all kinds of we've covered all the bases. But the visual itself of this platinum blonde white woman crowd surfing on this largely sea of brown people. And, you know, the standard defense of that is like, well, you know, this is supposed to be a real place in real time, and it's supposed to be a completely different nationality. And the retort to that is always like, yeah, this has got dragons, right? There's shadows popping out of people's vaginas. I think we could bend, you know, if you're going to bend the rules of history, you can keep bending them to be sensitive to the people from other cultures. And to an extent, you don't have to, but you get a much larger and more inclusive audience. Like, you know, obviously, there's tons and tons of black and other nationality fans of Game of Thrones. You see them at the conventions, mm-hmm. but it's also telling that they're almost always like the cosplayers I see are usually jokingly referred to this as Summer Island. Like, I remember there's a bunch of black guys are going around with like Summer Islander T-shirts on. Because like that's kind of like the only place you'll find black people in the books. And then a lot of times there's a lot of Dothraki, a lot of brothers cosplaying Dothraki. There's not a lot of great roles that have been given out. So, like I said, that's something we talked about. Like Mad Brew deliberately caused the kerfluffle just to back in. If you're a fan from the old days, just to discuss it on the wrap up podcast. And we had a lot of really interesting. I wish we still had that podcast because there was a lot of really interesting commentary from you know, people of color and whatnot that were responding to Mad Brew's, provoking the take that he was hoping to get. So that's the thing. It's like, this is a moment of triumph, but also, and then the thing is like, also I feel like that this was the start of like the Double D stepping in a lot. Like they had a couple of bad seasons where they handled some sexual power dynamics poorly. They changed some things in the books that made it even worse and more so. And there's like a and then this all led these next three seasons where they kind of had these cultural missteps culminated in them announcing that they wanted to do a fantasy history where the Confederacy won the war against the South. And people like, fuck no, that can't be good. that's my piece. I wanted to say it.
The thing about this scene for me is it almost feels obligatory. Guys, we're at the end of this season, the very end of this season, and we didn't go back to Dany. We don't really know her fate. She's still kind of outside of the city. Oh, fuck, write this scene. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like the sense of finality for the season from a lot of these other scenes.
Right.
And this is the one where they go, we need to cap this right. season.
Right.
And I guess, you know, that's the job of the final scene, but
right.
Dany is almost entirely absent in these last, couple episodes?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's other people doing stuff for her because her dragons aren't, you know, it's Dario saving the day and Jorah saving the day and, yeah.
Right. It almost didn't feel like that moment had been earned, I guess.
Right.
And so it just feels a little bit off to me. I think the finale or the final scene here could have been a little bit better with a little more support from previous episodes. But
yeah,
I don't know. Overall, love this episode. I think it's really good.
Yeah, no, it is a great recap. It is unfortunate that they tried to find the soaring moment of triumph and they kind of stepped into some cultural insensitivity. But yeah, you know, it's like, guys, I think there's a lot of ways you could probably film this to achieve the same effect, but made it seem like, you know, it's less, like a hate, like, oh, thank God someone came in here and saved us, and more of like a partnership and alliance kind of the way. I don't mean, I like none of this happened when Dany you know, ostensibly rescued the Unsullied, but the Unsullied had agency. They had swords and spears and stuff. Like, these people are coming out and they got nothing but the clothes on their back, so it's not like any kind of equal relationship. Even though, like, you know, reality, Dany does need, like, she's a queen with no people. Here are her people. And, like, what are people? People are artisans, they're craftsmen, they're farmers, they're laborers, they're soldiers, they're mothers. Like, there's, like, they're not just mouths to feed, which I feel like that's kind of how the scene treated them. Like, they're all these hungry, starving people that are just kept in check by all these dudes with swords and spears, and then Dany's crowd surfing them. Yeah. Yeah. It's like I can see where that doesn't come off as well as they'd want it to.
All right, that's the end of the episode.
Dany out. Hey, before we get to feedback, I want to talk about the club. If you have enjoyed our off-season coverage of Game of Thrones and you are looking forward to our return in as early as November to talk about the new Martin book and the Gods of Thrones, know that this like off-season type of coverage is only possible because Jim and I are fortunate enough to be able to do this on a full-time basis. And we're able to do this on a full-time basis because of the generosity of our fans supporting the club. If you go to club.baldmove.com, you can see all the extra features that you get for supporting our podcast. There's lots of different ones, and a lot of them are there with free samples. You can also try and sign up for a 30-day free trial of the club just by signing up. And again, you know, if we've given you some laughs, if we've been informative or insightful about some of your favorite pop culture, we really would appreciate your support at club.baldmove.com.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th,
Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
We actually have a good amount of non-spoiler feedback, so that's cool. We've been averaging just a trickle. We've got not a flood, but a decent amount.
Too Game little, too late, fans. We're not reading any of it. Can you try and pipe just in on the finale episode? No way.
Right. We're crowd surfing off on your emails. And I think that, you know, like I said, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com, we are not going to be coming back until November, but that's not that far away. Crazy enough, it's like a month and a half. So if you do have some feedback, you do have some thoughts about, you know, we're going to essentially be doing a book club about the Fire and Blood, the Targaryen chronology, that the history book that George Martin is gracing us with, and seeing if we get any new insights, if there's any game changers there. We'll also be talking religion because Anthony and I's book's coming out about then. So if you got some feedback about that, or it's probably not too early to start talking heavy into season eight. Although I will say that I don't know how to talk about season eight because I understand that there's spoilers starting to come out. So I kind of, like last year, I just ignored all speculation. And since there's only six episodes, I kind of feel like I don't care about internet points. I don't care about people being right. I care about the end result being satisfying. And I've heard from multiple other podcasters and columnists and people that like having those bullet points of what's going to happen robs you of your like first watch enjoyment. So I'm going to try to stay away from that. So maybe I'll take that back. We won't be talking much about season eight, but yeah, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. If you want to get in any of that feedback, when we do come back in November. All right. First up, Carrie S. I imagine that podcasting 70 plus hours of material changes how you experience the narrative. Then when I think about the time and effort to write a book on top, that must really shape your perspective. It's an important point. Like, you can probably speak to this, Jim, too. Podcasting a show is an entirely different experience from just watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always feel like I'm feeling that right now coming into The Deuce. Like, I watched The Deuce season one as a fan. Now I'm coming into season two and I'm doing it as a pod, you know, doing it the professional podcast job. It's tough. It's tough because I'm playing catch up, because like it's when you're just a casual fan, it's okay to like forget a few things or like, oh, I slipped that detail and I didn't catch where it going, because the showrunner is going to make sure you get caught up when you need to be. But if you want to be part of the speculation and the analysis and the helping other people to appreciate the stuff, it completely changes the way you watch a show.
Yeah.
For good and bad. But she says, in that vein, I'm curious if there's two to three things from your experience in writing the book that colored the way you rewatched this season. And adversely, was there anything through rewatch that made you want to make a tweak to the book? Because season three had plenty of religious elements to chew on. No, absolutely. In fact, this there's a whole chapter, which I'm not sure if it's going to make it volume one or volume two, that we devote to like Tywin, like Tywin and Roose Bolton's approach to politics and religion, like, you know, Tywin's whole thing of like, you know, it's family above everything. Mm-hmm. And that's something that a theme that we decided, obviously, before we watched the season. That scene with Kat, her soliloquy about John and her faith of the Seven and all that features prominently in this book coming out when we get to the faith of the Seven. So yeah, there was a lot of things in this season. I don't know that anything like impacted, but definitely elements from this season were crucial to shape some of the things we did that we end up writing about in the book. So those are the ones that just sprung immediately to mind. Moving on, Roger D, I want to do a quick shout of praise of the acting of Maisie Williams and the writing on her character Arya. For my two cents, the opening scene of this episode is a pivotal moment for her, perhaps her most pivotal moment. This is the moment she goes from being a traumatized and angry little girl to a cold-blooded machine, with the last vestiges of childhood being ripped from her body and soul. And the main thing that sells it is a phenomenal job of acting that Maisie does. Roger continues to gush for a bit, but I figured you and I could take over and do some gushing. I mean, we talked about it a lot, but goddamn.
Yeah, I guess I should feel that description more than I am. Ripping the soul from her body and turning her into a machine. I guess I didn't read quite that much into it. I think I don't know.
A lot of
don't know how much I can say about Arya without getting spoilery.
So Maisie Williams is blessed by having those ginormous peepers.
Sure.
That, like, you know, it's the window to the soul. So, like, if you're ripping that soul out, you're getting a front row picture of it, because it's just like these fucking anime Bambi eyes she's got, but they're so haunted and, hopeless. I have done podcasting about television for 8 years, and I kind of have been seriously paying attention to the medium for probably 8 more, and television and movies are replete with shitty child actors. And not maybe shitty child actors, but child actors that directors have no idea what to do with, and writers have no idea how to put dialogue into their mouths. And it's such a joy to see all of the children impeccably cast, with great dialogue and directors that get what you have to do to get the maximum effect out of children who haven't lived long enough to experience all the things that they're being required to emote. They need direction more than anybody. It's so nice to see them hit it out of the park on every single one of them. And like, how lucky we are that like Maisie Williams is so good, that Sophie Turner is capable of such a capable actor, and same thing about Kit Harington and all the rest. Like, they really rolled the dice on some of these real little kids and they hit pay dirt. So yeah, all props to them. Bryce W, just wondering, I'm not sure if you guys have talked about it, but why do you think Grey Worm is so scrawny? He doesn't look much like a warrior. Couldn't they have cast a more soldier type of guy?
We have talked about this in the past. We've speculated on what the castration does.
Testosterone. It's a hell of a drug.
Body. Yeah.
Look at all this. Look at all this. Testosterone.
Right. Grey Worm couldn't grow that.
Hell no.
Forget about it. He also can't grow as much muscle without as much testosterone.
Right.
So I think there are practical reasons for the way that the Unsullied look. Mm-hmm. And I also kind of think, who cares? But it does make them look a little less than intimidating, I guess.
But that's, you're supposed to understand that they're not great individual warriors, which is why Grey Worm's solo martial skills is a little universe breaking that we saw in the last episode. These guys are supposed to, they essentially have the bodies of a fit teenager. And they will forever. In fact, there's stuff in the book where you see Unsullied house guards for rich and pampered noblemen, and they've gone fat because that's the other, if you get castrated, you're prone to take those adult calories that you should be building muscle mass, and you just bulk up. Yeah. And there's a lot of fat, your typical kind of eunuch looking, harem guardsmen throughout the book and the margins of the details. But Grey Worm, since he's trained to be a warrior and he doesn't get a lot of extra food, he's got that lithe kind of teenage boy body. But you're supposed to understand that this Unsullied strength is their rigid discipline.
Yeah.
And much the Greek phalanx, they fight an individual hoplite was not a fearsome force, but 30 of them interlocked together, you couldn't break them. And the Unsullied are that to a ridiculously comically fantasy ideal. So yeah, you're not supposed to be individually find the Unsullied individually imposing. You're supposed to realize that 1,000 of these guys can break the swords of 8,000 Dothraki screamers outside the walls of a city. And which is something that actually has happened in the book. So
yeah, I think the failing here of the show, if I had to say there was any with the Unsullied, is that they haven't shown any of that.
Yeah.
Right. The most they've shown is one of their nipples being cut off and them not moving. Like,
right.
Sure, that's impressive, but it's also on an individual level.
That and also that doesn't win a war.
No, no.
Getting, you don't win getting a war hurt by voluntarily have your nipples cut off.
Right. Getting hurt and being able to take it is not what wins wars. The right. communication, the cooperation, and we haven't seen any of that yet. So, I don't know. It feels like they needed to show us something else of the Unsullied to really nail that point home.
Yeah, I mean, they did butcher the largely defenseless slave owners, but you're right. Like, you know, this. But on the other hand, they were introduced in this season, and they're kind of Chekhov's gun. Like, we've heard a lot about them. Now let's see what they can do, and we'll have to see whether those answers, whether that gets answered in later seasons to come.
Yeah.
Paul B. from Transylvania. I've been listening to your older podcasts in the off-season. I came across one where Aaron was talking about their initial coverage of the first seasons of Game of Thrones and told Jim that we should cover the first three seasons. Jim's reaction was hilarious, something along the lines of, whoa, 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 easy there. I'm not sure I'm ready for that kind of commitment.
I mean, to be fair, that's 30 hours of television and probably 60 of podcasting. So, yeah. I could see why I'd be a little hesitant.
Yeah. Now, so right on to his actual feedback. He goes, I was listening to you guys talk about the birth of the dragons and how only life pays for death. I'm not sure if this is canon, but I remember watching a video and he links to the fantastic, like, charcoal pencil illustrated videos that they come on every season of Game of Thrones, the Blu-rays. This one in particular is the history and lore of Valyrian the Dragons, produced by HBO. About the origins of Valyrian, where it was said that the people from which the Valyrians descended were peaceful shepherds until discovering dragons near the famed 14 Flames, which are the volcanoes indicative to the peninsula of Valyria. Whether this is an accident or divine intervention, who knows? But where else do we know in present-day Planetos where they're said to be peaceful shepherds? The Lazarene, a.k.a. the Lamb Men. From what I remember, the Magi, Miri Mazdur, was a Lazarene slave. My theory was that the Lazarene might have been descended from the same peaceful shepherds and ancestors of Valyrian. They might have been a faction who opposed the taming of the dragons, who were either outcast or decided to part ways with their more ambitious brothers. In this context, it's interesting and maybe a bit ironic to think that Miri Mazdur and her blood magic helped bring back dragons into the world. Thoughts? I wonder if you, because like, to me, this is very analogous to a real-world historical situation, and I wonder like what your thoughts are before I tear into it
with the dragons and all. Yeah, that's real world.
The dragons of India, for example.
Right
The Komodo, the famous Komodo dragons that won the Komodo wars for years.
I mean, in the course of history, if you look at it from a historical perspective, I don't know where the Lazarene make their home territory. Essentially, is it anywhere near these volcanoes that we're talking about?
I mean, they're all in the same continent. They're all in the same rough geographic. It'd be like Europe, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You see these kind of splinter groups coming off all the time, and you can look at, like, even the Targaryens themselves have splinter groups that kind of, you know, go and do their own thing.
The Targaryens are a splinter of the Valyrian people, for example.
Right, and they kind of preserve some of the traditions. The traditions change over time. So to say, like, okay, these are sheep herders, they're roughly from the same area, maybe I could see, you know, them being part of a splinter group of what eventually turned into the Valyrians.
Yeah. I think of, like, the nomadic sheep herding people of the Middle East and like how many fucking tribes that all had roughly similar gods and ways of thinking and geography, but one of those groups gave birth to so many different of the world's great religions. And like, you know, like at one point I was a Christian. Could I fairly tie my history back to these ancient Middle Eastern cultures? I mean, kind of not. Like, to me, I think that's where, like, I don't think there's anything to disprove your thesis, and it's an interesting thesis, but I also definitely don't think there's anything to prove it. And, like, to the extent that it's true, thousands and thousands of years before the Valyrian Freehold, that they were one particular, you know, type of, like, you know, that they're from the same kind of genetic stock. I don't know. Like, would that blow Miri Mazdur's mind if you said, hey, you're from the same people that tried to prevent the Valyrians from getting dragons in the first place? Like, maybe, but also have being burned alive probably burnt her, blew her mind too. So
Yeah.
It's good, but like it's one of those things where, you know what? Fire and Blood might have some answers to those questions. Is this George Martin? Are you trying to get revenge? Paul B. from Transylvania? Are you trying to get revenge on all the shit I've been talking, George Martin, the last few weeks by dropping some advanced Targaryen lore? Is that what's happening?
You would think George Martin would know that Transylvania is not a real place.
Right, right. That's where Count Chocula is from. Come on.
Yeah,
come on. Get a real country. I mean, that's actually great. That's a great theory, Paul. I actually kind of wish that it'd be worth an info box, at least in one of the books. I kind of wish I'd thought of it or you emailed me like 3 years ago so I could have forgotten the inspiration and just cribbed it for myself. But no, that's some good stuff. Lauren M, do you think Roose would have turned on Rob even if Rob had heeded his counsel during the war? I never think of Roose as being petty like Walder Frey, more like he just takes advantage of the situation. Great question, Jim. What's your analysis?
Yeah, I don't think he would have turned on him, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there were moments where Roose was very loyal to Rob. And when he was counseling him and Rob kept making mistake after mistake for silly reasons, in the grand scheme of things, Roose eventually said enough is enough. I got to do what works for me.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that like Roose, although the books give a little bit more context that like the Boltons and Starks are kind of ancient enemies. The Boltons used to be kings in their own right. And then the Starks they fought war after war. And, you know, this is still a good 1,000-2,000 years into the past, but you know, shit, a lot of stuff is a couple thousand years in the past that we're facing to, you know, the enmity that we face today. And it's still fresh in people's mind. I'm with Jim though. I think that Roose is a practical man. He has not chafed any more than he's had to against the Stark rule. And he, like, if he had an opportunity to take out the Starks, he could have. This was an opportunity that arose. But I think that he was a loyal bannerman trying to give Rob good advice until it became obvious that it was a doomed cause. And then what? I mean, like, that's the thing. That's the other side of this whole feudal system. Like, why the fuck do I got to die for this guy's doomed cause just because my banner's sworn to him? That's
right.
Pretty fucked up.
It is.
You know? Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, I mean,
like, what if your banner was sworn to, Robert Baratheon?
Right.
And then he dies and then Joffrey takes over and why be loyal to that person?
Yeah.
Why would you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I don't understand the post death, kind of pledges, you know, like those house pledges, because houses change significantly over the years. The people in them, the people running them, the causes of the houses change over the years. It doesn't seem like you can have an alliance that survives the people who made that alliance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question and something that like we even. I mean, obviously you can't if you're on the live stream. I have a banner flying behind me, and I have some complicated feelings about it at the moment.
Uh-huh.
Like it's something that you struggle with. Like, what is a pledge of allegiance even mean? What are these symbols mean? Are the symbols greater than the ideals they embody? Are they only given power by the men and women they're upholding it? And you know, the Stark banner wasn't what it was in Roose's eyes, and he took his shots and he takes his chances, and we'll see how that works out in the wars to come. Rich, you guys are doing an episode on the new Fire and Blood book coming out soon, so I was wondering if you could ever do an episode on the Dunk and Egg books. They're loosely connected to the show where both characters have been mentioned, but I'm interested in your opinion on them, and also will you or Aaron book be available on Audible? Thanks for going back and doing the commentary in the first three seasons. I don't think we're ever going to cover the Dunk and Egg stuff. Because I just don't think Jim's that interested in it. And I don't think Dunk and Egg are as interesting as the source material, the main canon. Hmm. I've read them all. I think they're pretty good, but they're not like Game of Thrones, Storm of Sword, Clash of Kings good. So probably not. Probably not. I mean, you can jump in here and just fiercely deny that we'll ever do that anytime you want, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, I have zero interest in reading the expansive tomes, even the mainline stuff. Like, I'm not going to go read the mainline books on Game of Thrones, or on Ice and Fire. So I'm not going to read these like side things. And
I'll play devil's advocate.
I'm not the lore guy.
All of the Duncan Egg novels are about 300 pages, sum total.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's not quite the commitment of the main canon. So I know that's what someone will say. Well, does Jim know that they're so short? Does that change your opinion?
Not really, no. Because I just don't have any interest in filling out the history of this world. I'm more wrapped up in the current events.
Right. And there is some foreshadowing and some prophetic detail and some other stuff that Martin is using. But, you know, that's the whole thing, right? Like, it can't be crucial to the main tome, or this information will find its way into the main tomes.
And you would think so, yeah.
It's a big ass to ask Jim to read a fantasy book, to be honest. Yeah. As far as the books being available in Audible, it just depends on how well they sell. We didn't raise enough money in the Kickstarter to hit that tier. It's kind of an expensive process. I will say that if they're not on Audible, that I can almost guarantee that I will take the time sometime this winter to read them and release them as in a podcast form. Because that's pretty easy to do. I can, you know, however many chapters there are in a book, I can do that many podcasts, sell them on some sort of online store, and then you download them and you play them just like any other MP3 file. So I don't know if I would like for them to be an Audible project, because it's easier. It's turnkey. You get it. You got a player. It synchronizes and whisper sync and all that kind of cool stuff. But it just depends on how well the book sells, you know. Sean McGee, last of the non-spoiler feedback, has no one ever seen Hodor react to a storm before? They all act like he is some new freak out, but how is it possible Bran didn't grow up with Hodoring in every damn lightning storm? They'd for sure have said, storm's brewing, gotta get somewhere where nobody will hear Hodoring. I mean, they didn't, when they shacked up in the tower, they didn't know that the wildlings were about to invade, right? I mean, that's the best answer.
So you're saying the new piece of information here was not that Hodor does this when there's a storm. It's
oh shit, there's wildlings. We need to be super quiet.
Yeah, this one particular instance, it was a bad idea.
Right, right. And also, maybe Hodor was in a familiar environment, like the castle he was born in, where he's lived all of his life, and like it's big, stout walls. Maybe it's. I mean, I could see like that not being a frightening.
Whereas, maybe if you're not scaring the shit out of him with your ghost stories every time you stop,
that too.
Talking about like, the fucking Rat King, talking about the probably a god of thunder who turned, I don't know, some big galoot into an ostrich. I don't know. What kind of fucking stories are you telling this guy? Of course he's scared.
Yeah, I can say as an expert in Westerosi religion that the god of thunder has got it out for galoots.
He does.
They're tall.
That's one galoot-hating bastard.
The lightning is attracted to them because they stand up taller than anybody else, and it's something that old Dan really beat into old Hodor's head, that you got to watch out for that god of thunder.
Yep.
No, I think, like I said, I think that there's... I could make an argument that maybe is the first time, or I can also make the argument that they didn't, when they found a place to hide. Number one, where the hell? I mean, they're in a fucking open plain. Mm-hmm. There's like expansive grasslands on the wall. If better a tower than anywhere else, but yeah, I think they expected wildlings to pull up on them. So
yeah,
that is the non-spoiler feedback. We are going to do a little bit of spoiler stuff in the spoiler section, as is our wont. But if you don't want to get in any of that, if you're not caught up on the books and the series, maybe bail out now. We will be back in November to talk about Fire and Blood, to talk about my book, The Gods of Thrones. We will see you then. All the spoiler friendly people, follow us into the spoiler section.
All right.
Okay.
Spoilers.
We got some stuff to talk about. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I have some things to talk about.
I got at least some
things to talk about.
Yeah. I want to talk about this potentially being the moment that Davos seals Stannis' fate.
Mm.
By releasing Gendry and pointing them north, it seems like he essentially killed Stannis.
That's not a wrong take, for sure.
Because this is an action, by sending Gendry away, this is an action that Davos has chosen to take, right? Like, you could say, oh, there are a whole bunch of chain reactions that lead down to that path, but this is a moment where there was a fork in the road and Davos chose the one path, which put Stannis on the same path as well.
Yeah. I guess it depends on whether you think that Melisandre could magic a victory for Stannis, because I don't see a way for Stannis to fight out of Dragonstone. It seems almost inevitable that Joffrey or somebody will get enough ships to go burn him out of there, and he won't have a Davos to deliver onions, and he'll either starve. He'll probably starve to death, honestly. Like, Stannis is that. He will starve to death at the gate, barring his hungry people from opening the door. Now, if you believe that Melisandre could burn Gendry alive and kill Joffrey and the other kings and make everyone else swear fealty, which maybe she can. Like, fuck, I don't know. Before I saw a shadow come out of her vagina, I had no idea she could do that.
Yeah.
She's got power. And it does seem to be fueled at some point by royal blood. I mean, that's the interesting thing, right? That, like, in less than four episodes, all the rival kings will be dead. Balon Greyjoy gets swept off of a bridge, but probably a faceless man got him. Joffrey chokes on some dry pie. Renly's already dead. Like it is something to make you think, right?
Sure. I mean, the kings are dropping like flies.
So yeah, if Melisandre could have magicked him a way out, because otherwise he doesn't have the ships, he doesn't have the men, he doesn't have anything to do an invasion of Westeros. So
right.
Whereas up north, he could rally the free folk, he could rally the Black Brothers, he could rally the resistance in the north to the illegitimate Bolton rule. Like, he's got some plays he can make. You know, ultimately, he doesn't, but what are you going to do? And that's with burning his daughter, the most royal of blood. So,
yeah.
Our Theon torture count's up to 7. Let's spend a couple minutes talking about, was it all worth it? Did you need all of them to get to the point where he makes him say reek?
Yeah. No, I think absolutely you do. I think, like I said, last episode, you know, since we don't have that POV from inside Theon's head, it's really, you got to get in there and you got to understand. The show has to make you understand that this guy is broken. And I think the 7 scenes that we get are enough to do it.
I think it's a pacing problem. I think throughout the second half of the season, there was far less torture. There was so I think that what they should have done, since there was nothing to tie that Ramsay Bolton storyline to anything else, it could have been in any order. Like, every two episodes, give us a dose of Theon, just so you know that you understand that all this time is passing and Theon is on this cross getting tortured. I think it's a matter of it pacing. Someone
they
also
just
wrote in
it too much or couple, what?
What's that?
They just front-loaded it too much?
I think so, because we got the, like, 5 torture scenes at week 5, and then we got the 7 by week 10. That's, to me, not paced appropriately. Okay. There's a couple, like, there's 3 episodes in a row where I don't think we even got to Ramsay. And then someone also wrote that this might also be a part, like, of the Where Are My Dragons, which we found, like, what was persuasive about that is every fucking... previously on, she was screaming, "Where are my dragons?" All of the trailers are, "Where are my dragons?" All of the... So, like, it was amplified and echoed, and I have to imagine that this Ramsay torturing stuff is, like, you know, if your stomach is full already and every previously on and next time on is featuring torture, it just amplifies and echoes it. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think we lose one, and we pace them every other episode, and no one has any complaints, because I do think you do have to tell the story of this man being destroyed.
Oh, yeah. And I think they did that pretty effectively. I also think, like, on this watch, I wasn't as affected by the torture stuff, I think, because I didn't see the previously on and next time on.
Yeah.
I was simply watching the episodes, because on HBO Now, they weren't showing a previously on. So,
of course.
It didn't hit me the same way as it would with all the previews and stuff echoing it.
Let's talk about, because I know this is something we've debated, and I think this episode puts it to bed. I don't think Tywin would have any trouble at all handling Joffrey. Joffrey would either get fucking religion, or he would take a nasty fall down the steps of the Red Keep, and it would be a damn fucking shame, but it's a good thing we got the handsome Tommen, last seen being murdered by Rickard Karstark and his men. to be resurrected and lead in Joffrey's place.
Let me ask you this. I think you're right about that.
Because go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you off.
Well, I was going to change the subject a little bit. So continue with your thought.
Well, I was going to say, like, I do believe that if Tywin fucks around and lets Joffrey like come to age, like 18, and then builds enough sycophants and retainers and gets his hands into some money where he can start like earning loyalty from people. But like but Tywin's not stupid. Like, I think Tywin gives this kid a year, maybe two, to start wising up, and then he does the, oh god, he had a I've been saying we should have fixed that step for years, and Tommen's first official act is going to make sure the stonemasons fix that fucking trick stair on the red. There's no way Joffrey outfights Tywin.
It is interesting to me to, you know, hear this vigorous defense of all that Tywin is doing for his family, and I wonder if how much the knowledge or the or Tywin suspecting that Joffrey might be part of his family, part of his actual blood family. I guess he is with Cersei, but like knowing that he's the product of Jaime and Cersei, how much that would have like changed his opinion on it, or even if maybe he does know that, because there's times where we think, okay, maybe he knows this, right? He's certainly heard the rumors. How much does he believe them? And he, you know, refuses to admit ever that that's actually what's happened here, even though he will admit that those rumors are going around. So I wonder if Joffrey gets a little more leeway, if like, would he kill Joffrey? Would he push him down the stairs of the Red Keep if he knew that he was actually like a product of Jaime and Cersei?
I think absolutely, because he's still protecting his family.
Yeah.
Like cutting off his
I think there's some, I think there's some hypocrisy there with not killing Tyrion, though.
I mean, I don't think, like, as we'll see next season, Tywin's not above killing Tyrion.
Sure, yeah.
Like if Tyrion, like if he becomes a threat to the family, and you know, and like the, and in this case, like, I don't think Tywin believes that Tyrion killed Joffrey. It's just that enough of the realm believes it, and Tyrion's always been a pain in his ass, and he's been making these threats in court, and Tywin's like, "You made your bed, kid." Like, and Joffrey being a crazy asshole would be that only more so.
Am I misremembering, but isn't Tywin's plan not to actually kill Tyrion? Isn't it?
He wanted him to take the Black, right?
Right. Yeah.
But I think Tyrion, like, shocked everybody by saying, no, I demand trial. And I think there was a debate about, like, if he lost a trial, could he still take the Black? And
Right. That's what I'm wondering. Like, is there a way, was there a way out that Tywin was planning for Tyrion? Because I don't know. I mean, there is a certain amount of hypocrisy in saying, I'm doing everything for the family, and then doing things for the family that involve killing the family.
Yeah. I think it's like, to me, everything, like, the family comes first, but that doesn't literally mean the flesh and blood members of the family.
They can be
sacrificed, they can be discarded, they can be, you know, set aside to serve the greater good of the Lannister dynasty, right?
The position of the family, right?
Yes. It's the family in terms of concept. Now, the hypocrisy is that essentially Tywin's vision of the family is himself.
Sure.
Like, he is the epitome of what a Lannister should be, because, duh, obviously. So it's pretty easy to meet the standard when you yourself are the one making the standard.
Sure.
So, yeah. Anything else we want to talk about on that subject? Because I got a couple other things.
Nope.
Man, what a kick in the crotch. The non-existent crotch in this case. I'm going to find my brother and bring him home. Like, they really make that moment heroic, and it is a real shit when it finally happens.
Or it doesn't happen.
Yeah, like, she does it. She fights, well, she gets in, and then Tyrion, or fucking Theon locks himself back in his own cage.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Doesn't bring him home. Later she brings him home, but...
Also, I was privately amused, and I'm not sure, because I don't think this line is in the book about the young wolf being forever young. But right around this season, there was a big theory going around with Roose Bolton being a secret vampire.
God.
And like his, like, you know, not drinking wine and toasting to being forever young, I thought was there's a lot of people making wry remarks about that. Finally, Gendry rowing. Gendry will row for the next three seasons off camera before we see him again. I wondered if like someone held a gun to your head at the end of season three and said, when does Gendry come back and how important he's going to be to story? You'd be like, oh, surely we're going to see him next season, right?
Right. You would think so.
But no, no. That's like one of the biggest enduring jokes of like Gendry's rowing and how jacked he's going to be in his arms and how he's going to swing that hammer. And yeah, turns out it's good for cardio, too, because he ran from the land of always winter to the wall in like an hour.
Right.
Right. What do you need? What, you know, what does a man of the jetpack need with a rowboat? That's what I want to know.
Fair.
That's all the stuff I had. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
Nope.
Let's get the feedback. GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. Bobby F. I've heard a lot about the actors for Cersei and Bronn and how they had some bad breakup and refused to be in the same scenes together. However, upon a rewatch, I believe I've spotted them twice in the same scene this season. During Sansa and Tyrion's wedding, Joffrey's walking Sansa down the aisle. You see them together twice, once when Bronn nods to Sansa with Cersei watching in the background, the other when Joff and Sansa are ascending the steps with a pan over the whole crowd. In fact, before the nod, Bronn appears to be looking Cersei's way, and Cersei does appear to keep her head down and eyes averted the whole time, at least until Sansa is up the steps and past her, so she doesn't have the risk looking at Bronn. Not sure what make of all this, just an interesting observation to me. Could have been green screened together from two shots? Was it just Cersei playing the pious mother figure? Is the whole they won't act together thing totally overblown? Jim, what do you think?
Man, regardless of whether or not it's true, the concept is such a fucking stupid one. Like, look, you idiots are both paid to be here.
Absolutely.
You're paid to do your job. Suck it up, you fucks, and get in the same... Like, if I want to do a fuck scene with you two together, I'm paying you to do that, and you should be up for it.
Right.
Because that's your goddamn job. Do it.
Yeah, it's a lot of a lot of pressure on Bronn to be up for that scene.
Absolutely, but he should. He's getting paid Game of Thrones money to do that, so do it.
So the legend I've always heard is that they had previously dated, but the bad blood was more recent. Like something happened in season two, or maybe even filming of season three. But I'm with my co-host here. I can't believe that if the director came to these people both and said, you need to be in the scene together, they're going to be absolutely not. That'd be so fucking unprofessional.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you probably don't get hired again after that.
I think that, you know, like a wise writing room and director staff takes their star's wishes. Like if there's been like a bad romance that like, you know, you don't needlessly, you don't just write a scene for the fuck of it. You wouldn't do like a Robert Baratheon, Cersei, you know, because that's got that bad chemistry has got to affect the performance. So keep him apart as much as they can. But like, and they were also in the same set when they were doing the, they were in the same set during the Dragon Pit negotiations, I thought too. Wasn't Bronn there?
That sounds right.
So, like, it's not that they can't be together. It's just that, like, it's that that's their preference, right?
But I mean, look, you're professionals, right? What if Cersei and Jaime were dating at one time? The actors who played them, and they had a bad breakup, and they didn't want to be in the same scenes together. The writers can't work around that.
Right.
You can't. So you got to be there to do your job, and if you're unwilling to do that, then you shouldn't be there at all.
I think it's a lot. It's pretty played up, honestly.
Probably.
Kyle N, I have a question about George R. R. Martin's unfinished books. What if the general outline he gave to the Double D's was basically the same thing that they did, such as to go grab the zombie and the dragon gets turned into a white? But once he saw the fan reaction to this plot, he thought he had to make something better for the books, and now he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, we've discussed this at length.
This is a perennial topic for discussion, and whether you think that's despicable or smart or whatever is like a purely subjective opinion.
Yeah.
I think that Martin's more of like, well, I just do it better. Like they just didn't do the reveal correctly. Like, cause he's been distancing himself from a lot of these decisions. And even the way, even if the decision's ultimately the same, that like it happens in different contexts in the book. So I think he's prideful enough that he would stick to his guns and just try to do it better. But it is some A-B testing he's getting away with, right?
Right. That's the thing. Like if I were in his position, and I don't think I would be in his position because I think I would have signed that contract and wrote the damn books.
Right.
Lived up to my end of the responsibility. But since he hasn't, he gets kind of a weird free pass opportunity to beta test his books, you know, his stories.
Right. So. And it also gives him the parts where like, oh, this isn't very believable. I better punch the shit out of this. I better punch it up. I better really, really make this meaty or it's not going to land. Like that's a hell of an advantage. It's a hell of an advantage.
It sure is.
Finish the damn books, George. Brittany C., in the last podcast, you guys were talking about whether or not fates are predetermined in the Game of Thrones world. Aaron had mentioned it's hard to prove whether someone's destiny is set or not, because it seems like once someone hears about their future, they start to work towards it. But what about the case of Cersei? It seems like she went running the other direction when she was younger, and that witch told her what her future had in store, yet so far the entire prophecy has come to fruition. I don't think she was ever actively working to make the prophecy come true, and yet it did. That's the only example I could think of, but I thought it was a good one.
Yeah, that seems fair.
So I guess I'm going to sound like I'm a big hypocrite and I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. Let's see if I can be nuanced about it and avoid that. I think that, like, I'm a man of science, right? And you believe in double-blind tests. The double-blind test someone's destiny, they have to fulfill the destiny without having knowledge of that destiny. Because Cersei had knowledge of the destiny and tried everything she could do to make it not true. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the things she did were antagonistic and made the things more likely to happen, like her suspicion of Tyrion and her thinking that he's going to be the Valonqar and her being distrustful and distasteful of him her whole life and pinning the murder on Joffrey and making him flee so that he gives his giant brain to Daenerys, who is maybe the younger, prettier queen that's going to replace her. Like, a lot of the shit she did and trying to overprotect her children made it more likely for them to be the types of people that, yeah. So it's like, I shouldn't have said, like, it's a Job Jonah situation where that guy found out God wanted to do this thing and he just did the opposite of it. It's more of like God wants Jonah to go and preach to the city of Nineveh, but he's not going to tell Jonah because it's his destiny. I don't have to. I fucking did. I made it his destiny. It'll happen. Like, that's what I'm wanting to see. Like, we know, like a character that we can see is fitting all the prophetic, but that has no idea that they're actually fulfilling prophecy. That's never going to happen because that doesn't follow the hero's journey and it's not interesting, but it's what I want to see as a man of science.
All right.
Do you have any additional thoughts on that, Jim?
Nah, I'm good.
Here's one. Can you help him out with this, Jim, in the post-production? It's been a while since Aaron has done some... with all the air horns, how about we get a little hype since this will be the last Game of Thrones podcast for a while?
You got it.
Here's a little bit more hype. So Anthony and I are brainstorming thing. Like, we got this artist, Chase Stone. He does badass art. He did a lot of official work for the World of Ice and Fire. He's done a lot of Magic the Gathering. He's done a lot of he's just like a badass fantasy author. He happens to also be a fan of Bald Move, and we contracted him to do some illustrations for our Game of Thrones books, our Gods of Thrones books. Anthony and I were brainstorming, like, you know, because you can't just have him illustrate copyrighted material. You can't have him draw Sean Bean, right? One of the things we thought, because we were doing some of the things we do in the books, there's like for each chapter, there's like a fan theory that kind of goes along with it. And we're choosing to have him illustrate some of the popular fan theories, like the Clegane Bowl. Mm-hmm. Roose Bolton, Vampire Lord. And I think I cannot wait to see, because, like, there's very, if you think about it, as popular as the Clegane Bowl is, air horns and all, there's very little art of it. Like, doing a Google search, I could only find one piece of art that imagines what that would look like. So that's one of the things I'm really excited. I haven't even seen the rough drafts of this yet. It's something he's working on right now. I'm like, soup. So if you want some hype, check that out, man, when the book comes out.
You're gonna get all the Instagram follows when that comes out.
Let's see. Patty McSee, I've immensely enjoyed your discussion about Tywin this season. During this episode, Joffrey insults Tywin and Tywin sends him to bed. What do you guys think would happen if Joffrey gave the direct order to kill Tywin? Would Tywin still have sent him to bed, or would Joffrey have killed him instead, or would he have killed Joffrey?
No, man. I think Meryn Trant is gonna take Joffrey's orders. And if Joffrey says kill Tywin, there's nothing Tywin can actually do about it. The Tywin's power is all in manipulating Joffrey. Mm-hmm. And in the perception of power, right? Like Tyrion mentions, you know, it's not the death that I'm looking for, it's the fear of death, because that's the thing that controls those people. That's what I think. Like, Meryn Trant will perhaps even gleefully strike Tywin down if Joffrey commands it, but Tywin has such a hold that Joffrey will never command it.
I have a different take. I just think that if Joff says kill this man, Maren Trant looks at Tywin. Charles Dance activates his last action hero eyeballs, so they literally turn into crosshairs. And Maren Trant says, and packs Joffrey to bed.
You know what Trump's crosshairs? A fucking sword to the throat. Like, what's Tywin going to do after he's dead to you? Nothing.
I don't know. Because, like, if it's any other Kingsguard, I think you're right. They like fucking Barristan Selmy absolutely guts Tywin like a fish. Gerald Hightower.
I'd like to see that.
Sir Arthur Dayne, because that's how fucking serious they took the office. These fuckers, they're just thugs and plate enamel. Nah, because I think that they think the bigger payday is supporting Grandpa.
But
they're not in it for honor or prestige. I mean, that's one of the subtexts is like Joffrey's Kingsguard is shit. It's shit from the top down. Like they're just like all the good guys have left and have been killed or gone. And now you've got like one or two guys. And in the books, they're sent off on assignment and you just got the thugs that are left. And
at that point, Maren Trant would be delegitimizing Joffrey as the king because
yes,
you can't let that stand. And that would, I mean, talk about crashing your dynasty. If the king is completely illegitimate, And the King's Guard don't support him, and everyone finds this out, the king is a laughingstock. Your dynasty is gone. Like, they're... I don't know, man.
Because
what happens after that moment, right? Maren Trant says, nah, no thanks, Joffrey. Not going to do it. Disobeying a direct order from the king. Where does that go from there? That escalates with Joffrey, right? Joffrey turns to the other King's Guard and says, kill Sir Maren Trant for treason.
Right.
And it goes down the line until he finds somebody who will. And I don't know, man.
This is a very specific situation. We're talking about these chambers where there's like five of the most powerful people in Westeros and two Kingsguards and the king. Like, I think it's a different question if it's out on the street. I think it's a different question if it's like in a royal wedding scenario. Because like, you know, Maren Trant like is a craven, but he's not a fool. Like, I think he can do the different like societal math, but like, how would it get out? Who would leak it, I guess? And could Tywin, you know, could Tywin make the people that would leak it fearful enough of their lives if they did so that they wouldn't? That's the thing. That's what Tywin just like. And honestly, if it got out, I think Tywin would get off on it. The fact that like he's so powerful that he can essentially spank his grandson across his knee and not suffer the consequences. I think the small folk would eat that up. The lords and ladies would eat that up. It would delegitimize Joffrey, but fucking Tywin doesn't give a fuck because he's the power behind the throne.
For now, yeah. But I mean,
and that's what I'm saying. He would absolutely kill Joffrey if he didn't get religion in the next year or two, I think. But
okay,
you know, yeah. I can see where you're coming from too. Esteban says Melisandre asked Beric Dondarrion, what do you see? And he says nothing at all about his resurrection. He also asked Jon Snow the same question, and she receives the same answer from both men. For someone who's lived a very long time, I wonder why she asks about the afterlife. Wouldn't her character be happy about that answer? I guess I'm confused, Esteban, because I think that her what she wants them to hear is it's the other side, and the other side is, you know, for servants of the light, which I think she believes both of these men to be, Beric, a card carrying one, and Jon because he's Azor Ahai. I think she wants to hear that there's like the Lord of Light's open is there with his arms open waiting to receive you. So I think it's disquieting for her to think that there's nothing. Because she's put off death for a long time. Why? Because she's afraid. Like, that's always an interesting thing about, you know, like, you know, it's like people make this joke about the popes all the time. Like, you know, you don't often see popes turning down state-of-the-art medical care. Right. Like, if you're on the launch pad to heaven, why wouldn't you set that rocket off? Like, Neil Armstrong wanted to fucking go to the moon, right? So like, why the chemo, dude? Like, God already told you he wants you here, or he wouldn't have to give you the tumor. Like, he's got the power over that, right? Like, I think this is kind of a similar kind of weird hypocrisy there of the faithful.
Is the, as I understand it, the Lord of the Lights thing is kind of, or that religion's thing is kind of the existence here on Planetos or wherever the hell they are,
right,
in this plane is kind of a hell.
Yeah.
And that by extinguishing that, you are essentially freeing them, the right. people from hell.
Right.
Into what? I don't know. I think they call it the darkness, which I guess could be represented as nothingness. So if John is seeing nothing,
yeah.
and Beric is seeing nothing, could that indicate that they're dying at some point?
I think you're right, but I think that shows that Melisandre really is hoping for something, like, you know, being released from this hell to go, like, to not the sweet bliss of non-existence. She wants a reward.
Oh, she doesn't want to just not exist. She wants to exist in a different...
And I think the Lord of Light does have a concept of the afterlife. I don't think it's official church doctrine that it's like nothingness. Like, I think there is supposed to be an other side where, you know, what that looks like maybe is not really well defined. But there is an expectation that your soul will be delivered to the Lord of Light and, you know, he'll welcome you into his arms and et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, final piece of feedback for this season. Cody S. Has a rapid-fire, quick-answer, crossfire-type segment.
Okay.
Do you think a dragon will have to be sacrificed by the Red Witch to bring about Lightbringer?
God. Rapid-fire?
Yeah. What do you think? Yes or no?
No. No. I think it's just going to happen.
Yeah. In fact, I think... The more I think about it, the more I think the Lightbringer is going to be a metaphor for a person rather than a physical thing that's wielded. Because I've always said, I've been saying this for a couple seasons, the idea of Lightbringer, like John's going to have this magic sword that just like shoots a beam of light Zelda style out and kill, like that seems ridiculous.
Right.
But John being tempered over the course of many times up into death, or Danny the same way, being tempered over the course up into death, and being reborn, I think that sounds like Lightbringer to me. What would be more satisfying, Jaime and Bronn betraying, killing Cersei, or the Hound and Arya sent to assassinate her and the Mountain?
Oh, Jesus. Probably Jaime. There needs to be some larger thing for Jaime and Cersei, and I don't think this little breakup that they've had is it.
Yeah, the Valonqar that's supposed to choke her to death is translated as little brother, but like the little brother she never saw coming... Jaime, who was born before her, right?
Doesn't that make her the older brother? Or make him the older brother, rather?
Well, no, Cersei's born first. So
oh, Cersei was?
Older.
Okay.
Yeah. What do you think of the Pirates of the Caribbean 3 type ending? Say if John will be cursed and die, and Danny will only find out he's related afterwards and she's pregnant. which is what the theory he's... So he's going after like some kind of... you know, John is like maybe becomes Lightbringer and he's welcomed into the arms of the Lord of the Light, and he comes back once every 8,000 years and the Long Night comes back and reborn as Azor Ahai. I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know.
I'm going with a yes.
I mean, it sounds bittersweet. So why not? Can Bran steal the Ice Dragon?
Yes.
That would be pretty cool.
I think Bran can steal many, many different types of creatures.
And we've always said that would be a cool three, like the drag, like, you know, it's a head fake that Tyrion makes him a dragon saddle. If he just wargs into,
right?
Can he warg into the Ice King? I don't think he can.
I don't think so. No, that might be the exception to the rule.
A mere white. Like, yeah, I think he can warg into that.
Yeah.
Will Bronn finally get his castle?
No. I unfortunately for Bronn, I think this castle has been a pipe dream the whole time.
I think Bronn, do you think Bronn survives? Because I think George sees them using kind of like cockroach quality to Bronn, that no matter what happens, that he will always land on his feet. And I think absolutely survive.
Sure. But I don't think he's getting that castle or the beautiful wife that he's looking for.
I kind of do. Yeah, I'll go. I just fuck it. I like it. I like a final shot of him bouncing his new baby boy on his in his hall and his castle. And he's got a Westerosi hot. He's got like a Westerosi 7 or 8 for a wife.
Yeah.
You know, which is like a Lysian 5. You know, if we're being honest. But I like Bronn. I want him to be happy. So that's it. We unfortunately have to sign off here. We'll be back in a short couple of months to talk about Fire and Blood and Gods of Thrones. Then we'll be back just a couple months after that to talk about the final season of Game of Thrones. Thank you so much if you've been participating in our summer rewatch. I know a lot of people have. It's honestly, it's like we had almost no fall off from the last time we did this, which was right after the last season. So people are hungry for this. Thanks for your support of Bald Move. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all the feedback. Thanks for making it fun. We will be back in a couple months. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.